Picture the last 20 feet. You're on short final. The number's sliding up toward you and the airplane is pointed maybe 10 degrees off the runway heading. The wind is shoving you sideways. Your instinct, the one nobody taught you but everybody has, is to straighten the nose and just land. And if you follow that instinct, you're going to touch down drifting. The tires are going to screech and grab, and the airplane is going to try to swap ends on you. That moment, that last 20 feet, is where more check rides quietly go sideways than almost anywhere else. Sometimes, literally, this is Radio Hangar. I'm Pattern, and this is Traffic Pattern, the show where we try to make you a better, safer pilot one flight at a time. Today, we're going to talk about the crosswind landing, the wing low side slip, how it actually works, what the examiner is looking for, and one number on your airspeed indicator's cousin, the placard in your pilot's operating handbook, that I promise you is misunderstood by more pilots than any other number in aviation. Let's walk through this together. Before we go further, a quick word about our friends at aviationsoul.com. They make challenge coins for every step of this journey we're all on. First solo? There's a coin for that. Private pilot, instrument rating, commercial ticket, they've got a coin to mark every one of them. Learning to fly is long and it's expensive, and the milestones can slip by without ceremony. A coin is a small way to say, that mattered, I did that. Check them out at aviationsoul.com. All right, the crosswind landing, here's the fundamental problem, and I want you to really sit with it. Because if you understand the problem, the technique becomes obvious. When there's a crosswind, the wind is moving the whole mass of air your airplane is flying through. You're an object suspended in a river, and the river is flowing sideways relative to the runway. So even though your nose might be pointed straight down the centerline, your actual path over the ground is drifting off to the downwind side. You have two problems to solve, and they are two different problems. Problem one, you're drifting sideways across the ground. Problem two, when you touch down, your wheels need to be rolling in the same direction the airplane is moving, which is straight down the runway. If they're not, the airplane gets a violent sideways load the instant the rubber meets the pavement. There are two ways pilots solve this, the crab and the side slip, and the check ride, the airman certification standards, and frankly, good airmanship all point you toward one of them for the touchdown itself. Let's take the crab first because you've been doing it all along on your cross countries, whether you called it that or not. In a crab, you point the nose into the wind by some angle and you keep the wings level. The airplane flies a straight track over the ground, even though it's pointed off to one side. It's efficient, it's comfortable, it's how the airliners do it right down to the last second. You've been crabbing on every windy cross-country you've ever flown. The problem with the crab is the touchdown. If you're still crabbed when the wheels hit, you land pointed one way and moving another, and that side load is exactly what we're trying to avoid. The airliners handle it with big sturdy trucks for landing gear and a technique that kicks the nose straight in the final instant in your Cessna 172 or your Piper Cherokee. We're going to use a cleaner method for the final part. That method is the side slip, the wing low side slip to be exact. And here's the beautiful thing about it. It solves both problems at once, and it lets you see whether it's working the whole way down. Let me build it for you piece by piece. You're on final. You've got a crosswind from the left, let's say. Here's what you do. You lower the upwind wing, left wing down into the wind using aileron. Just a little at first. The moment you bank, the airplane wants to turn, so you stop that turn with opposite rudder, right rudder, in this case, aileron. Into the wind, opposite rudder to keep the nose straight. Now stop and think about what you've just created. The airplane is banked slightly toward the wind, so a component of your lift is now pulling you sideways, into the wind, exactly canceling the drift. That solves problem one, and because you're holding opposite rudder, the nose is pointed straight down the runway. That solves problem two. The longitudinal axis of the airplane is aligned with the center line, and you are no longer drifting. Here is something I wish someone had told me when I was training. The amount of aileron and the amount of rudder are not linked to each other. They are each doing a separate job. The aileron controls your drift. Are you sliding toward the downwind side? Add more bank into the wind? Are you being pushed to the upwind side? Take some bank out the rudder. Completely separately, controls where the nose is pointed. Nose drifting off the centerline heading? Adjust the rudder. That's it. When I was a student, I kept trying to find the one correct combination. The magic setting of aileron and rudder that I'd hold all the way down? There is no such setting. The wind changes as you descend. It's usually stronger up high and lighter in the flare as friction with the ground slows it down. So you are constantly, gently adjusting both independently all the way to the pavement. Aileron for drift, rudder for alignment. Say it to yourself. Aileron for drift, rudder for alignment. Now, how do you know it's working? This is the part I love, and it's what makes the side slip superior for training. You have a perfect, continuous readout right in front of you. It's the center line. If the center line is sitting still under your nose, not drifting left, not drifting right, your aileron is correct. If the nose is pointed straight down that center line, your rudder is correct. The runway is giving you a live report card the entire way down. Watch the center line. Let it tell you what to do. Let's talk about the touchdown, because this is where the wing low method really pays off. In a proper crosswind landing, you do not touch down on both main wheels at the same time. You touch down on the upwind main wheel first. The left main, in our left crosswind example, then as the airplane slows and the wing loses lift, the downwind main settles on, and then last of all, the nose wheel. Upwind main, downwind main nose, in that order. And here's the part students always find surprising. You do not take out the aileron after you land. You keep feeding it in as you slow down on the rollout. That wind has more and more authority to lift the upwind wing, so you keep rolling the aileron in toward the wind, more and more until at a full stop, the yoke is in the corner, all the way over into the wind. This is that climb into the wind, dive away from it rule you learned for taxiing, and it applies right through the rollout. The wind doesn't stop being a threat just because you're on the ground. Ask anyone who's had a gust get under a wing during rollout. Now, the number I promised you, the one that's misunderstood more than any other in aviation. Open your pilot's operating handbook and you'll find, usually in the performance section or right on a placard, a figure called the maximum demonstrated crosswind component. In a lot of trainers, it's around 15 knots. Cessna 172, somewhere in that neighborhood depending on the model. Here's what almost everybody believes it means. They think it's a limit. They think if the crosswind is above 15 knots, I am legally or mechanically prohibited from landing this airplane. That is wrong, and the misunderstanding cuts in a dangerous direction. So listen closely. The maximum demonstrated crosswind component is not a limitation. For most of our light general aviation airplanes, it's not a regulatory limit at all under Part 91. Here's what that number actually is. During certification, a test pilot, a professional, sat in that airplane and landed it in a crosswind. And that number is simply the strongest crosswind they happened to demonstrate during the test program. It might have been the windiest day they had. It might have been all they needed to satisfy the requirement. It is a demonstrated value, not a structural ceiling and not a legal wall. So why does it matter so much? Two reasons. And they point in opposite directions, which is exactly why it's dangerous, reason one. The number is not a promise that you, on your worst day, can handle that much wind. A factory test pilot demonstrated 15 knots. That tells you very little about what a 40-hour student can safely manage on a gusty afternoon. So do not treat it as a green light. Your personal limit, especially early on, should be well below the demonstrated number. Set it on the ground before you fly. When you're calm and honest, maybe it's 8 knots, maybe it's 10, write it down. Because the cockpit on short final is the worst possible place to negotiate with yourself about how much wind is too much. Reason 2. The other direction. Because it's not a hard limit. The airplane does not magically stop being controllable at 15.1 knots. Pilots with skill and currency land these airplanes in crosswinds above the demonstrated figure all the time, safely, on purpose. The number is information, not offense. The judgment is yours, and judgment is exactly what the certificate in your wallet says you're supposed to have. Let me put a real scenario on it. You're a fresh private pilot, 3 weeks past your check ride. You planned a Saturday flight to an airport an hour away for lunch. You get there, you eat, and while you were inside a front nudge through. Now the automated weather, the ATIS, is calling the wind 15 gusting 22, and it's nearly 90 degrees across the only runway. You do the math on the crosswind component, and it's most of that wind, call it 14 gusting 21 across. Your handbook says 15 demonstrated. So a lot of new pilots stand there and think, well, 14 is under 15, so I'm legal, so I'm fine. Do you see the trap? You just used a factory test pilot's best day as your personal go-ahead, and you ignored the gusts, which are the real story here. The spread between 15 and 22 is 7 knots of gust, and gusts are what balloon you, drop a wing, and turn a nice approach into a go-around you didn't plan. The mature answer, the one that keeps you flying for 40 years, might be to wait 2 hours for it to settle, or to have someone drive out and get you, or to fly to a nearby field with a runway pointed more into the wind. None of those feel heroic. All of them are the right call. Getting the airplane and yourself home in one piece next Tuesday beats a bent airplane and a phone call to the insurance company today. Now let's bring it back to the check ride, because a lot of you are training for one right now. On your practical test, the examiner is going to want to see a crosswind landing, if there's any crosswind to be had. Let's talk about what the examiner is looking for in plain language. They want to see that you maintain the center line. Not that you're glued to it perfectly, wind is wind, but that you're actively working it. That the airplane isn't just wandering while you hope. They want to see coordinated, deliberate control inputs. Aileron into the wind, rudder holding the nose straight. They want to see you touch down with no side drift on the upwind wheel, with the airplane's nose aligned with the centerline, and they want to see that aileron come in during the rollout, not get abandoned the second you're down. Read the Airman Certification Standards for yourself. Pull up the Private Pilot ACS, the Airman Certification Standards, and find the task for the normal and crosswind approach and landing. It lays out the touchdown standard right there, a specified distance beyond a point you pick, at a proper airspeed, on the centerline. Know those numbers cold before you show up. The examiner isn't trying to trick you. The standard is written down. It's public. Study it. Here's the mistake I see bust more crosswind landings than any other, and it's not a stick and rudder problem, it's a decision problem. Pilots wait too long to go around. You're in the flare, the wind gusts, the upwind wing pops up, you're drifting toward the edge, and you're now fighting the airplane. The correct answer, 9 times out of 10, is not to save it. It's to add full power, get the nose to a climb attitude, clean up the airplane, and go around. Fly the pattern again. There is no rule that says you have to land off the first attempt, and there is no examiner alive who fails a pilot for a well-executed, well-timed go-around from a bad crosswind setup. The opposite is true. Salvaging a landing you should have abandoned is what busts the ride, and out in the real world, it's what bends the airplane. Decide early, when in doubt, go around. One more practical takeaway before I let you go, something you can do on your very next flight. Go find a windy day. Not a scary day, a day with a nice steady 8 or 10 knot crosswind, and go do low approaches. Not full landings, low approaches. Come down final in the wing low side slip. Hold the airplane a few feet off the runway, tracking the center line, and just fly it down the length of the runway at 10 feet, working the aileron and the rudder, feeling how they each do a separate job. Then add power and go around and do it again. You'll learn more about crosswind control in 3 of those than in 30 rushed full stops, because you've taken the pressure of the touchdown out of it and you're just learning to fly the airplane. Take an instructor, make a morning of it. Aileron for drift, rudder for alignment, upwind wheel first, and that number in your handbook is a test pilot's data point, not your permission slip. Thanks to the FAA's Airman Certification Standards and the Airplane Flying Handbook for the standards and the technique behind today's segment, and to your own pilot's operating handbook, which is sitting in the airplane right now waiting for you to actually read the crosswind section. You can find us at radiohangar.com. I'm Pattern. Go find a windy day and a patient instructor, and I'll see you back in the pattern.